Log Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Hollywood Boulevard podcast, hosted by Jonathan Moody and Donnie Sturgis.
Hey, 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 cinephiles. This is Donnie Sturgis, along with Jonathan A. Moody. We are two crazy guys hosting the Hollywood Boulevard podcast on Blog Talk Radio. With us tonight, we have our producer, Sierra Holmes, and we have a special guest, Alfred Crane, who's also going to be here with us tonight. And tonight we're talking about John Carpenter and the films of John Carpenter. So I guess without further ado, we'll dive in. Does anybody have anything like they want to say just first off about John Carpenter? Like, because I'm a huge fan. I've seen almost all of his movies, and I find him to be one of my favorite directors. But I also I understand that he's the type of director that not everybody gets, and some people only like a couple of his films, like the more commercial ones, and some don't. So, but I'm curious as to like Sierra, Alfred, either one of you guys want to chime in, where's John Carpenter on your radar? Like, how do you feel about John Carpenter as a director?
This is Alfred. I just wanted to say live from Antonio Bay. Homage to The Fog, which is a great film.
Oh,
and Adrian Barbeau. And I love to how he used Tom Atkins as a pretty good character actor. He just kind of showed up as kind of a tough guy, kind of like he always kind of had those bugs. But I would have to say my first memory of John Carpenter was watching The Thing. I was 12 years old, and my dad was deployed to Korea, and my mom and I were up watching it. Why she let me watch it under her supervision, I don't know. But as soon as and the movie's great, I mean, I could talk a whole hour about it. But the part where the guy's chest cavity opens up, where he's about to do the magic paddle, that was it. We turned it off after that, and it was about a number of years before I went back to watch it, which has turned out to be one of my favorite films of all time. It's in my top 10, definitely.
Yeah, and I really like them. They Live. Especially, you know, with Roddy Piper. I thought that was a really great movie.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic film.
And he likes to work with Kurt Russell a lot. Do you guys notice that?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Him and Kurt Russell are really big friends. Kurt Russell and him are very, very big friends. They've been friends for a long, long time, and you know, not so much anymore. But back in the early days especially, he would use Kurt Russell a lot in his films. In fact, I think he uses him the most out of everybody, or almost the most. I think there's one other actor, like a smaller actor that I don't know too well, that he's used maybe more.
Well, I think
time.
Charles Cypher is probably when, you know,
yeah.
as far as John Carpenter, because I noticed that like in the early John Carpenter films, going back from Assault the Precinct 13, he used Charles Cypher in like everything up until I could be wrong here, so. I'm wrong. Please correct me, but I think Escape from New York or Christine might have been his last. Which one?
Escape from New York was his last one. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think that's right about the same number of times. I think him and Kurt Russell are kind of matched for the number of times. No, actually.
Peter Jason was used a lot too. I mean, there's a few.
There's definitely. Absolutely. But yeah, I think Carpenter is one of those things where I got into Carpenter films when they used to show them on like the ABC Monday Night Movie or whatever when I was a kid. So I remember I saw Halloween that way, I saw The Thing that way. I did it for television, obviously, and The Fog. But he's one of those guys where he's a mainstay. Like he's been in the game for a long, long time, and you know he's seen his share of commercial hits and as well as ones that didn't do so well, but have gotten a huge cult following. And, So it's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about him on one of the episodes is because he's got an interesting career. You know, he had a really good a series of commercial hits in the 80s, and then suddenly he kind of dropped off. Like, he was still putting out movies in the 90s, but his commercial success started to fade, and it was more along the lines of, like, hit-and-miss kind of cult-type movie. So let's see. I guess we should talk
one
about
thing
I guess we,
to, oh, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I just want to throw out he inspired a column I wrote in I was a student at Christopher Newport, and I became the arts entertainment editor my senior year in 1995. And
sure.
We were trying to come up with a new weekly article, which turned out to be what I named the Video Alternative. And my first one was to get these movies that come out, and then what else could you watch that could be comparable? And I think it was when In the Mouth of Madness or Village of the Damned came out. And my first one was take a stab at John Carpenter for people who might not have been familiar with his works in the mid-90s.
Sure.
So he started my foray into kind of some editorial journalism and writing a weekly column. But I agree with you. He had a lot of great stuff early on. And then his later stuff just kind of defaced. It's like some stuff was good and some stuff I wanted to like it better than I thought it turned out. But just a brilliant all-around guy. To write, direct, cast, and make your own music is just incredible. And he's got some unforgettable themes.
Oh, absolutely. The man's a renaissance man, if anything. I mean, the music, he's done movies. Like, he pretty much does it all. So I guess...
actually, right now, he's actually on tour showcasing his musical scores.
Yes. Yes,
really?
He is. Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, he's even got there's a special set out right now that's basically like the lesser known scores are basically, but it's a compilation of a lot of the work that he's done, or most of the work that he's done over the entire career, which I haven't had a chance to pick up yet. Yeah, actually, you're right. It's exactly what it's called. Thank you. So as far as his commercial success versus his cult status, why do you think, I mean, just put it out there, anybody have any ideas as to why they think maybe, you know, his commercial success kind of ended in the 80s or why he's managed to maintain a cult status despite the fact that his commercial success went down? We can probably talk about that for a little bit and see where that goes.
Well, I'll just say this out there that if you notice, like, his career track, he started with, like, an independent film with Assault, Precinct 13. Then he did Halloween right after, which is still an independent film. Then he did Elvis with Kurt Russell, which was like a TV movie. And then
right.
he did, you know, he did like Someone's Watching Me, which is a TV movie, and he's done a few other ones. But then later he did, I think his next, like, was it like The Fog was independent, and then like Escape from New York might have been a little bit more studio.
Mm-hmm.
think he's been kind of alternating from both, you know, one or the other, and for a little bit. And if you notice, like, it's more commercial stuff nowadays, like Ghosts of Mars or
sure.
you know, Vampires or you know, things like that. They're probably his, like, least watched kind of movies. And I think that's just because, you know, I don't know. It's just the time, I guess. You know, it's just not. We can get into that later, I guess.
I think I agree. I think part of the reason was that I think the times changed, too, because there was a lot of – the 80s had a lot of successes and a lot of different type of movie genres and stuff that just didn't quite cut it. When we went into the 90s, our taste changed, our mentality changed, politics changed. And I think the films that came out of the 90s reflected that. And I think John Carpenter was one of those people where – he had a really perfect thing going on in the 80s, you know, like his movies were just hitting the right niche for everybody that wanted to see them. I mean, like even as far as like the late 70s, you know, with Halloween, you know, basically helping create the slasher genre, like he was doing some really important work. And then I think like by the time the 90s rolled around, we already got to the point where people were kind of getting sick of the standard type of films. like horror movies and stuff. And so they started deconstructing them, like with Scream and everything. And I think Carpenter kind of got caught up in that because I think part of it was just the fact that, you know, he's such an eccentric like type of artist. Like he has a very specific, like he likes to mix genres. Like he likes to do like a cowboy sci-fi movie. You know, he likes to do all these weird things. And I don't think everybody was really able to tie into that. And I think that's why his cult status has remained, because all of the people that kind of get him just still love his stuff regardless. And then the mainstream just kind of like, well, I don't, this guy, what is this guy doing? Like the 90s kind of changed everything. So that's just my opinion as to why I think his commercial success kind of faded when the 80s went out. It was just because mentality changed and the mainstream just didn't, they couldn't latch on like his fans could. And so, you know, there was just kind of a tonal shift in the way, in the type of success that he saw.
Yeah, that, I remember seeing that happen with, I didn't get into John Woo. I mean, you talk about another guy another time, but he'd had a lot of commercial success in Hong Kong. And then when he came over to the States, his movie just didn't have the same punch. So I wonder if that transition from an independent studio to studios coming in saying, well, we know how to make you better. Like,
sure. That's actually a good point, too, because that ties into it as well, because Memoirs of an Invisible Man is a prime example. That was one of the first movies he did in the 90s, and it was a commercial failure, and part of that was because of the fact that at that point he had become such a hot commodity, but the problem was is the studios wanted to tell him how to make a movie. And he was already coming into a film that was supposed to be for another more mainstream director anyway. So you have this guy who works in a very like narrow niche, you know, trying to do a broader type of film, and it just wasn't a good fit. And so I think that was the beginning of the downward spiral. So I think you make a good point on that one.
I remember hearing an interview with him where he was discussing like interference with the writers too. A writer that was bothering Kim Cattrall on set of Big Trouble in Little China, and you know, and things like that. And just she was just telling John like, get this guy away from me. He's, you know what I mean? And like people were just kind of coming in and telling him what to do and telling other people what to do. And I think when he does his independent films, more or less, you know, it's like he has more creative control. And when he has more creative control, he can kind of take over the project and make sure that it's John Carpenter's project, like he has on his, like everything is John Carpenter's whatever, you know.
Except for Memoirs, because he really didn't feel like he had a real controlling grasp on that film, so he didn't title it with John Carpenter.
It's funny though. I enjoyed that movie. It had a lot of good stuff in it. And one of the things that's funny was I just had this. It's almost funny that his movies kind of started going downhill, and so did Chevy Chase.
It's true. I don't know if they're related, but they definitely do have a similar trajectory. Yeah, go ahead.
No, well, I was just going to say, I want you guys, at some point, if you guys ever get a chance to, read a book by William Goldman. It's called Which Lie Did I Tell? It's a amazing book on, it's like More Adventures of the Screen Trade or whatever. But it talks about, they have a bit about Memoirs of an Invisible Man, because William Goldman actually wrote the original draft for that. And originally it was packaged as
Princess Bride.
William
Goldman.
Right? Yeah, Princess Bride and Misery's. William Goldman, and he also did. He was also like producing or writing it. He wrote it, and it was packaged with a director. Like that was part of their deal, right? And the director was a director and actor, so it's all 1-3 package. They all like were the same agency and everything, CAA, I believe. And they all basically, what ended up happening is William Goldman was set up to write it. Ivan Reitman was set to direct it. And Chevy Chase was set to star in it. And then Chevy Chase said, well, I want to explore the invisibility of, or the, no, I want to explore the depression of invisibility or something like that. And, you know, and how the loneliness of it and stuff like that. And he wanted to be a real actor, you know. Problem is, Chevy Chase is, you know, is the na-na-na-na-na guy from, Caddyshack. He is not.
Sure.
He is not to me. He's not a, you know, a real actor. You know, like a dramatic actor.
Well, I think part of the problem there was that a lot of those comedic actors were doing that jump right around that time. You had Tom Hanks was jumping over to more dramatic films. Robin Williams jumping over, and I think Chevy wanted to get on that train. Unfortunately, it just didn't work for him. And then you're left with a movie that's totally totally uneven because the balance between horror or between drama and comedy is very uneven, and it's all over the place. I like the movie, okay, but you can definitely see where the movie tries to be funny at one moment, but then tries to be heavy the next, and it doesn't really line up very well. It's a very uneven film.
Well, that the way that movie ended, I was just thinking about that, and that's just what I loved about one of the big things growing up is like John Carpenter's trademark is like, is it over? You know, it's like
right.
This movie didn't really end. It's always over, left hanging.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the...
Except Escape from New York, that ending had the best, like, that's over ending, you know? Like,
right.
He ended it. I think I told Donnie earlier, I'm not a huge fan of Escape from New York. I rewatched it, and it just doesn't...
And
I forgive you for that. Yeah, I know. I mean, whatever. It's all good. But that movie does have one of the best endings in all the John Carpenter movies I've seen. You know, the way it ended. But, you know, I don't know.
American
I'm weird. I don't know. I just think Snake Plissken was kind of boring, honestly. I prefer Jack Burton over Snake Plissken any day.
And to be fair, that's part of the... And this actually helps me transition over to one of the other things I wanted to talk about, too, is like his filmmaking styles and his techniques. He's very much into the long-form storytelling. He, you know, there's a lot of his movies I've heard the same complaints about a lot of his movies across the board. I've heard people say that Halloween is too long and has long stretches of boringness. I've heard people say that about The Fog. I've heard people say that about Escape from New York. So it's just one of those things where he has a very specific style of storytelling, and he really, you know, he likes to linger. He likes to, you know, really kind of just do the long-form storytelling. And so, and sometimes it doesn't always work for a lot of people. Some people want a little more fast-paced and everything, whereas he likes to linger a little bit longer, you know. Because I've heard that complaint about Halloween and The Fog so many times, and, like, I get it. It's just, for me, it's I don't mind the pacing of his films. I like the slow burn. I like the build-up, you know, to what's going on, so... But
and you also get to care for the character. I get to know the characters a bit better instead of just going right into a meat grinder of a film. It's like, oh, I actually care about Jamie Lee Curtis. Oh, this Donald Pleasence guy is really interesting.
Right,
New York, or I want to know more about these people. And most of the time, you wind up dying, but that's great. Pretty good writing.
Yeah. Even if you look at, well, I guess Big Trouble in Little China is probably one of the few films where it actually kind of jumps into the action quite quickly. I mean, because it's pretty much from the beginning, you know, once he follows Wang back to the, you know, to the restaurant and everything, they've already gotten into a mess, you know. So it's, you know, there's already stuff going on. So, but most of the time, like, even when They Live takes a while in that first act to get anywhere. It's basically just watching Rowdy Piper, like, walk around and talk to people for like a good, like, 15 minutes. And then you finally get into the nitty gritty where he discovers those glasses, and then it goes from there. But I don't know.
That took a half hour. I timed it. It was a half hour, and they timed the glasses. And that really annoyed me because I was like, where are the glasses? Like, you know, like, I thought this movie is about him finding glasses on the ground. And so, you know, it took about a half hour, then he finds the glasses, and then it's another hour. Like, it's one of the shortest of his movies. And it's like, then it starts to get, like, pick up. And, I mean, half that movie is that fight scene, literally. You know, like, oh, my goodness. Sierra, you said you watched They Live, right? Like, what do you think of that fight scene between Keith David and Roddy Piper? Like, that
scene
was
insane. That scene, yeah, I love that scene. That was incredible.
that scene is one of my favorites.
It's legendary. Yeah. Like,
people parodied that.
Who would have thought you could take a fight scene and stretch it out to like 20 minutes? Like, that's ridiculous. Like, but he does it. I'm entertained.
Especially
like,
over wearing sunglasses.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Over wearing. Exactly. Like, just two guys scrapping in a back alley, throwing each other into dumpsters over a pair of glasses. But he makes it work. Like, it's just.
Yeah.
How many times they're kicking each other in the ball?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Neither one of them are having children anytime soon after that.
I mean, that all looks real. I don't know. And, you
know,
it's
like a game of Rochambeau gone sour. It's crazy.
I had heard that Kurt Russell was originally thought of for the role of that. There was two reasons, like, that he turned it down. One reason might have been because, he isn't the build that he was looking for or whatever, so he wasn't exactly what Carpenter was thinking for that role. However, also, another reason why is because Kurt Russell is very one, I don't know which way he is, like, but John Carpenter and him are very different in political opinions, and that was definitely a political movie.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, on one side.
Oh, my goodness, was it ever.
which,
to be fair, a lot of John Carpenter's films have some sort of, I wouldn't say political, but he's not like a social commentary in like George Romero or something, but he definitely has a message in almost all of his films of some sort. But yeah, I think They Live is the one that's the most, like, in your face about it, like, you know, and I can understand that. Like, I can understand why the politics would keep Kurt Russell off a film like that, especially, you know, considering just just how in your face that is. But
one of my favorite things about
what's that
about character development was that I never paid attention. I was just so engrossed in the thing, the story, the people, and everything else. I didn't pay attention to one thing until I listened to the commentary with John Carpenter and Kurt Russell, where he said there was no comic relief dude. Like, there was no Rob Schneider running around to break the tension.
True.
I mean, the guy on drugs, I mean, he was whacked out of his head, but his stuff was just coming out. Like, one of the greatest quotes of all time was, like, when the head sprouted legs, and he's like, you've got to be friggin' kidding. I mean, that stuff's funny, but it's like people in a dire situation. And just the way they acted it, and there was no, like, person going, hey, how about this? Oh, boy, you're funny, Jack. You know, it was just kind of like, damn, they're in this situation, they're making the best of it. And, you know, I just thought it was brilliant how they did it.
Yeah, I
agree. Go ahead, Donnie.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, yeah, it's a brilliant film, and there's some really great moments in it. I totally agree.
Well, I totally agree, too, but, like, my thing is, like, I can watch The Thing, like, over and over again because that movie is so just good. But, you know, and you're engrossed even though there isn't comic relief. There's barely any comic relief in Escape from New York, and that movie is just brutally... I don't know. Like, I don't really know how I'm describing it, because I'd seen it years ago and I remember liking it, but then I rewatched it now, and maybe it's just the fact that I've watched so many movies and especially John Carpenter films that my friend and I looked at each other and were like, this is the most overrated John Carpenter film of all time. It starts out with Snake Plissken, you know, finding out it's like a video game, you know, and, you know, and everything. And the problem is, it's just like a video game. There's no, like, you know, I don't know. There's no fun to it exactly. Like with character interactions and stuff, it's just kind of like, hey, I'm going to go save the president. I'm going to say this line, and his lines aren't even witty or anything. It's like, call me Snake, call me Plissken. You know, right? And they're not that funny. Like, I don't know.
Well, to be fair, Escape from New York came out right before the big action films, because that was like 81, and so the big action films didn't start really coming into play until a couple years later, and that's when we had, when Arnold Schwarzenegger came on the scene, that's when pithy one-liners started to become the norm. But before that, any type of action film really didn't do that as much, so it's kind of why you don't see as much of that in Escape from New York, because it kind of came out before that big blow-up of funny one-liners, you know, as you're taking out a dude. Well, you know, in an action sequence.
And so, I agree with you, Donnie. Because coming out of the 70s, most films that were in the 70s were slow-paced. They didn't have, like, most of the Dirty Harry movies were very good.
Yep.
There wasn't a whole lot of action. And just, like you were saying, just in that transition into the 80s, stuff started to get a bit more, if you want to use a better word, colorful or just more fast-paced.
Oh, yeah. So once you got into the Reagan era, it was all about excess. It's like, how many big explosions and how big and beautiful and colorful can we make it? How big and over the top? Because we were all about consumption and over excess and stuff. And so the movies, you know, probably around 82, 83 is when they really started to catch on in that regard. But, I mean, a lot of the stuff in the early 80s were still kind of products of the 70s. And so they had that more long form storytelling, where like the Dirty Harry movies and stuff, where even the science fiction movies. I mean, if you look at stuff like Close Encounters, nothing really exciting that happens in that movie. You know, it's just you're just watching this guy go along this route of in his life, you know, trying to figure out what this thing is, and you know, it was just a different time. And so, I mean, I totally get people that to be fair, Escape from New York isn't even in my top five. I like the movie a lot. It's probably my top 10, but it's definitely not my top five. So I can understand, you know, people not really liking Escape from New York as much. And like I said, Jonathan, if you would probably like Escape from LA more. You would probably enjoy LA more than you would New York if you gave that a watch. I would highly recommend it, because you might actually enjoy that one more, because it's really Escape from New York, but it's more over the top. It hits more of those action beats that you're looking for. More of the funny one-liners are in there. That's probably the one that you will prefer over the two. You know, so that's, you know, something to think about.
I need to give that one another viewing too, because that one I had high hopes. A lot of times I set my expectations up here and they were down here. So
sometimes
I need to set them for what they are. It's John Carpenter and Kurt Russell running around doing crazy stuff, which is what I'm paying for.
Yeah, right.
All right, I just want to mention real quick that I posted, we discussed John Carpenter this coming Monday on Twitter. I said, which the horror master, because that's what he's on Twitter as, film do you like the most? And they only give you four options for Twitter polls, you know. So I put Halloween, The Thing, Escape from New York, Other, leaving comments, right? Halloween is at 43%. The Thing is at 37%. 7% is Escape from New York, and 3% is Other. Out of 30 votes, so this actually got more responses than Alfred Hitchcock one did. So just letting everybody know, we're going to be doing it for every week that we do the show. We're going to be posting a poll, and you guys can go and vote on Twitter. So add us at Hollywood, which is HLLY Wood Bullet BLVD Pod. That's, you know, for Twitter. Add us on there, follow us on there, and let us know what you guys think of these films and what, you know, I think we had a couple comments too. I don't think people like the fact that, one person said Halloween was the best. There was a guy named Sam Tumminello said that. I'm probably saying his name completely wrong. Dylan Miles says, I mean, this seems to be an unfair question. The answer is obviously The Thing. That film is damn near perfect. So I will be reading your comments and everything.
Not.
Hey, this seems to be a consensus for most people. Was that?
Where do you guys think Prince of Darkness would fall? I mean, I thought that movie was pretty scary.
Prince of Darkness scared me. You know what?
That, That is my number one favorite. I talked to Donnie about it earlier, and that is my number one favorite. So I'm glad you brought it up, because I was going to bring it up before the show ended completely.
I like Prince of Darkness a lot. It's not my top five either, but I like it a lot. I think the problem I had was I saw that one probably like last year, because I finally, when Scream Factory finally put it out on Blue, it was one of the ones I hadn't. It was one, because I've seen pretty much all of his movies, and that was one of the ones I hadn't. And so I finally picked up the Scream Factory Blu-ray last year and watched it, and I liked it. I enjoyed it. It's got your standard Carpenter tropes, you know, tone, you know, the use of camera angles and long lingering shots that he does. There's a lot of really great things about it. I think it's not one of my favorites, mainly because I think part of it was my fault. I went in thinking it was going to be something else entirely. Prince of Darkness, the first thing I think of is like, oh, it's a vampire movie. And then I found it's kind of more, it's nothing like that at all. And so it's one of the things where I need to rewatch the game in the right mindset, and it'll probably go up a few points for me. But for the most part, yeah, I was, you know, I liked it, but it was just not up there with the other ones for me.
The thing that go ahead, Sierra.
No, I was going to say, you know, Alice Cooper was pretty creepy in it, you know?
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, hell yeah. He's one of the best parts.
He was wonderful in it, but I don't know. What were you going to say, Alfred?
Oh, the parts I loved to creep me at the most was the VHS videos from the future where you're trying to, the thing come through the portal, and you're like, what in the hell? That scared the crap out of me. It's so creepy.
I swear to God, I think most people should do, if you're going to do a horror, like a sci-fi film and set it in the future, like Escape from New York was set to be 1997, you know?
Sure.
And that was, you know, obviously, we don't know, and then was it, Blade Runner, I think the original Blade Runner was supposed to be that year or something, like in
1990. 2019.
And was it?
2019
yeah.
was Blade Runner.
2019, actually.
Okay. So it's coming up, and I'm pretty sure they're not going to look anything like that. But, I say set a freaking movie in, like, the year 30-something, because we're all not going to see that. So we have no idea what the year 30-whatever is. Mm-hmm. And then it'll be, like, really fun for people who, if they ever get to watch that movie, you know, that, you know, like, to see what we thought the 30-30 would be, you know. always funny to see 2000 or 1990, and we're just like, that's nothing like what we're like.
I think there's a couple reasons for that, too. There's a couple reasons for that. And it also depends on when the movie came out, too. There's a couple reasons for that, though. And part of it's because, you know, back in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, the year 2000 seemed like it was so far away. You know, we'd already done these really great accomplishments, and we really thought that our trajectory was going to be a lot. We were on a fast track to these huge, big, amazing things. And the 2000 was the future. Like, it was a huge thing. We have more realistic sensibilities now than we did back then. Again, especially going in the Reagan era, we had these over lofty kind of ideals, you know, thought we were going to be doing more than we did. But nowadays, you know, we're more realistic about the way, and that's part of the reason why we don't try to do that as much as we used to. But at the same time, there's still certain years that people like, they love the idea of playing with the fact that, hey, what if, you know, an alternate future, or, you know, what if 10 years from now everything was kind of cool? People kind of like to explore that space as well. So, I mean, yeah, I don't think it's ever really going to go away, but yeah, definitely, I understand where you're coming from on that. Like, it was so weird because, like, Transformers the movie was, like, set in the late 90s, and then, like, we were, like we get to, the late 90s, we're like, yeah, there's no robots. What's going on, man?
One good thing about Prince of Darkness was it came off of Big Trouble in Little China, and he usually kind of works with some people again, so it was good. It was
That's
really
true.
Good to see the lead characters, or the supporting characters from Big Trouble in Little China in that movie, and
it was great.
It's funny because I watched Big Trouble in Little China again. Like, I hadn't watched it in a little bit, and I rewatched it just recently. And then I watched Prince of Darkness right after, like the day after. Perfect, because I was like, "Wang," you know.
Yes.
There's everybody like from the movie. You know, people probably thought I was insane yelling "Wang" randomly. out.
I will say this. I do love the cast for Prince of Darkness. It is a great cast. Like, Alice Cooper is amazing. I think you nailed it, Sierra. Like, his work in that film, so creepy and effective. Like, they made good use of Alice Cooper in that movie.
I forgot he was in it. But now, as soon as you brought it up, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right, because he was a creepy homeless dude.
Yeah, he was. Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. He sold it, too.
And then Donald Pleasance was good as usual. He was excellent.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Actually, it's funny that you say that, because after rewatching Escape from New York, I was really disappointed by Donald Pleasance in that movie. I thought he was his character, just they didn't give him enough to work with.
Sure.
But in Prince of Darkness, they give him a lot to work with and stuff, and I really enjoyed him in that. But I feel like I'm just, like, this whole episode, I'm bashing Escape from New York. It's really not that bad, people. Watch the movie. You know, whatever. It's just, I think I built it up to be, like, you know, something that I was so excited for, you know. And I'll enjoy it. I'll probably watch it again, and I will listen to the commentaries, because Kurt Russell and John Carpenter have the best commentaries ever.
Oh,
so,
they do. They totally do.
Yeah. So I will enjoy it, but... It, you know, and I'll learn things from it, you know, from them talking.
Sure.
But I don't, it's just not a movie that I think is going to be, like, on my top. I don't honestly know if it's on my top 10, John Carpenter films.
It's not well,
I like
top,
that.
Well,
oh, I was going to say about casting, about that. It was Carpenter, he liked to use... or likes to use that I appreciate was older actors that weren't washed up, but he brought in, like, Ernest Borgnine and Lee Van Cleef for Escape from New York, and then he brought in Wilford Brimley, the Oatmeal Man, for The Thing. And I just really liked that he would bring in old ones and bring in new ones, but some people he would work again with, and Donald Pleasance, of course.
Sure.
But he's got a lot of old actors who would, and then, like I was saying before, Tom Atkins, he just plays this tough guy kind
of.
Tom Atkins, the guy who always seems to get with girls half his age.
Yes.
Jamie Lee Curtis.
Jamie Lee Curtis, and then Halloween 3. In Halloween 3, he's with the daughter of the guy that dies, that gets killed, and, like, she's half his age. I was like, what is going on, dude?
That's funny. I never thought of that. That's hilarious.
This is funny. They keep giving these women half his age to be his romantic interest. And I'm like, well, no. Tom Atkins is great and all, but no. No, there's no way.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, going back to Prince of Darkness, I liked how at the end you never knew if the devil was coming.
Right.
Right.
I like how he kind of did that. So it keeps you questioning.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's funny because, like, of all the movies that got a sequel, well, I guess technically The Thing got, like, a remake, but we don't talk about that, but Halloween got the sequels, you know, that became, like, the franchise kind of thing, and Carpenter has been stated, you know, basically, oh, and Escape from L.A. also, but he really doesn't like sequels, you know, he doesn't, and he didn't even think Halloween needed a sequel, but, I mean, money is what
That's the only reason why we got a Halloween 2 is because he did Halloween 2 because he hoped it would help him make other movies that he wanted to make.
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny you should mention the bleakness of Prince of Darkness, Sierra, because that's actually one of Carpenter considers The Thing, Prince of Darkness, and In the Mouth of Madness as part of his Apocalypse trilogy. Because all three films have bleak endings, which is an interesting thing.
Dad, what type of
I love In the Mouth of Madness. I love that movie. That wouldn't be my top 5, but that would definitely be on my top 10 list.
Yeah,
I think if I had to rate all my top 5, and I thought about this today, number 1 would be Prince of Darkness. Number 2 would be The Thing. Number 3 would be Halloween. Number 4 would be Big Trouble in Little China. 5, They Live. And then honorable mentions were In the Mouth of Madness. Christine, which we didn't talk about yet, I don't think. Kind of. think we, you know, crossed over a little bit. Crossed over. I know, like, there's so much that you could talk about on his film.
I know, right?
And then, you know, there's so many. And then The Fog, obviously. So, but yeah, I mean, there's so many films that he's done.
Yeah. How much time do we have? I think we only got, what,
yeah,
5 minutes left?
6 more minutes, yeah, something like that.
I'm just going to say that, you know, John Carpenter, he's an icon. I mean, how many directors can you say years from now that you're going to remember? But he's definitely going to be one that you remember.
He influenced pretty much every genre that he had a hand in. Like, The Thing was an influence a lot of sci-fi movies. Halloween was influenced the slasher genre. You know, there's even people take things from Big Trouble in Little China because of the Western aspect of it. You know, it's amazing. Like, the man is just an influence, and even his scores, like his musical scores too. The man knows how to man a synthesizer. Like, that man knows how to his way around a synthesizer like no one's business. I love his synthesizer scores. I love them to death. They're the best. I love synthesizer anyway. I'm a huge fan of 80s synthesizer music anyway, so that goes right into my, like, it's like perfect for me. So
I spent a long time looking for the audio cassette for the soundtrack to The Thing because I thought he composed it and it was Ennio Morricone.
Ennio Morricone, yeah.
And I kept seeing Ennio, and I was like, no, it's not. I was confusing myself, and I was like, oh, shoot, that's it. And
yeah, it's one of the few times he didn't score his own flick. There are a few times. That's one of them. I guess let's wrap this up a little bit. Jonathan, you already gave us your top five. Sierra, what's your top five, John Carpenter, if you can do a top five?
Definitely Halloween's up there. Halloween, I like The Thing. Big Trouble in Little China. I'm a huge fan of that one.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. And
They Live,
you were
saying earlier, and
what was
oh,
that?
Yeah, They Live.
Oh, yeah, They Live. Yeah, I love that. And it's just the Thing. I would say The Thing is up there pretty much, too. I mean, I like all his movies. It's hard to rate them.
Sure, I get it. Yeah, absolutely. Alfred, what about you?
I would say my top five would be The Thing. Let's see, it's going to be hard to put them in order. But I would say my top five would consist of The Thing, They Live, Prince of Darkness, Big Trouble in Little China, and The Fog. And Escape from New York would probably be an honorable mention. I didn't replace it with something else, but those are mine because I really like Prince of Darkness scared the crap out of me, but it's just such a good movie. I mean, for something to scare you, one of my friends literally jumped in the last scene, but. And of course, Halloween. I would move Halloween, Big Trouble, The Thing, They Live in the Darkness would probably be it.
All right, Daddy, we've got like 3 minutes, almost 2 minutes left. Just
all right,
you know.
Let me throw my top five in there real quick, and then we'll wrap it up. My top five is my number one favorite is The Fog. I think for me it's the perfect ghost story, and I love ghost stories. I think it's atmosphere. It's great. I love that movie to death. The Thing is number two for me. Number three is Big Trouble in Little China because that movie is just so much fun. In the Mouth of Madness is my number four because that movie it haunts me. It is so disturbing and unsettling. And number five would be Halloween. And the only reason why it's so low is just because I'm not a big slasher fan per se, but Halloween it set a lot of trends. And so that's why it's my number five, because I love watching it every year. So because of that, it gets my number five. So, and I
awesome.
Think with that, we'll go ahead and wrap the show up. Next week, I will not be available for the show. I'm heading up to PA to visit my folks. But the show will be going on. Moody will be in charge. I'm leaving him the keys. They're really his keys anyway. And we are doing, what were we doing again? Are you doing?
I'm doing Adam Sandler next week.
Adam Sandler next week. And
Sierra, you're
that...
good for next week, right?
Yes.
As my producer. All right. We'll talk about it today, later today. So, but yeah, later tonight we'll talk about it. But we do got to wrap it. It's going to cut us off. So.
All right.
All right. Well,
thanks
thank
you guys
so much.
Thank you
signing
all for,
off
for joining us.
All right. Everybody have a great night.
All
right.
All right. Bye.
Thanks
bye.
Again, Jonathan.
Yes. Yeah. Bye, guys.
All right. Bye.
Bye.